Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I have to apologize. I won't be able to be here for the panel because of a plane schedule. Usually I talk about water and not much about soil, so I think you all have me at advantage. I really like the idea of the initial theme of this, that maybe water is more valuable than land, and actually I'm not entirely, I know the value of price of agricultural land varies a lot depending upon what it's used for. What's it in the Salinas Valley? What's the price of an acre of land in that area?
$50,000
an acre. So there, I'm pretty sure that even the annual value of that capital investment is probably still more than the value of the water. But in some parts of the Delta, you'll have land that has a value of maybe of $4,000 or $5,000 an acre. And if you take the annualized value of that capital expenditure, certainly in this drought year, the water is more that you're putting on that land is more valuable, because the market price for water in the Central Valley these days is probably between $500 and $1,500 an acre foot. So I think it's an interesting question. Many of you have seen slides like this before already, showing the wonderful disparity we have in where the water is and where the water demands are in California. How many people here are not from California? Oh, okay, great. All right. So when I first came to California almost 30 years ago now, I experienced abrupt climate change because... Yeah, those of you that live here know. Okay, so we don't have rain-fed agriculture here to speak of. We have irrigated agriculture. And not only does the water fall at the wrong time of year, and there's not very much of it, it falls in the wrong places. And so these maps, I think, show that well. And my job is I'm a professor of civil and environmental engineering, which California is great for this because in order to make this spatial and temporal mismatch work, you need a lot of engineers to build a lot of big things. And you've seen some pictures of some of these big things. And there's a little person next to one of these big things. State Water Project, you've heard mention of that earlier today. We move water all over the place here. It's really great from an engineering perspective. Just to highlight, you've seen the map on the right before that shows how much we've transformed the landscape in the Central Valley, but I want to spend just a second on the map to the left that shows the tall dark blue bars show how much water is available in each of these different hydrologic regions of the state. And you can see in the north, that's where the water is and where the people ain't. So you can see there's a fair bit of water there, and we call the water use there environmental. That's what... In the Department of Water Resources, if it's not used for agriculture, if it's not used by cities, they call it environmental. Just about, that's almost the accounting. That's a little bit crude, but it's about true. Down in the Tulare Basin, where the previous speaker is from, you can see they use more water than they have. How is that possible? Maybe some of you are familiar with this concept of conservation of mass. How do they do that? You got to bring more water in from someplace, and they do in amazing amounts. Tulare Basin not only brings more water in from other places geographically, but it also brings water up from down below, and so they have a tremendous overdraft. Southern California, where we are now, they also, you can see the urban use is very high here, and they have to bring water in from the Colorado River and from Northern California to supply those needs. So we have a really interesting place to study water. On the environmental side of all of this, all of the infrastructure and the water management and the agricultural development have really changed the landscape. As pointed out by some of the earlier speakers, we've lost about 95% of the wetlands in the Central Valley. This has not been so good for the flyways, for waterfowl, or for the native species that grew up rearing and spawning in many of these seasonal floodplains. We've done a lot to try to help out the critters here, the native species. This is for freshwater fish, but we're still seeing more and more trouble with them. We've, in the last 20 years or so, we've basically doubled the number of listed endangered fish, and about half of the number of species are in good shape as they were 20 years ago. So California is basically a dry place with a lot of different water demands. I think the earlier speakers summed this up quite well. I find it really amazing. This drought has really accentuated it to me, that California is a very, very dry place. It's a Mediterranean climate, so it's got a peculiar climate where it doesn't rain in the summer. I tell my students, my foreign students, that every year California has a worse drought than most of the United States has ever seen, ever, right? And we've built infrastructure and institutions to make up for that partially. Just like the East Coast has hurricanes, it will always have hurricanes. We will always have droughts. We just have to build our infrastructure and our expectations around that, just like on the East Coast, you have to build it around hurricanes. In comparing our Mediterranean civilization here, Mediterranean climate civilization here, with other parts of the world that have the same kind of climate, it's really kind of amazing to me. If you go to Australia, anywhere around the Mediterranean countries, Chile, we have a bigger population. We have a far bigger agricultural economy, far more prosperous agricultural economy, a much, much, much greater, larger, more prosperous overall economy. Agriculture is only 3 or 4% of the statewide economy in California, even though it uses 80% of the human water use. And we actually have more of the native species hanging around than most of the other Mediterranean climates of the world. So we can complain a lot, I think, about how we manage water in California, and there's a lot of improvements we should be making. And one of the reasons why we do so well is because we complain a lot, I think. But we do actually do pretty well compared to other parts of the world with similar circumstances. That's not an excuse to be complacent. I think that's just, we're not doing things terribly in that sense. Anyway, so you can see here that the center picture here is the city of Sacramento, the capital of California, in the 1860 flood. So we have really great things going on here with water. We have a lot of reasons, there'll always be a problem here, but I think the problems here always change over the history of California, and we have some good reasons to hope. And these charts show a couple of nice things. The one up above shows growth in agricultural and urban water demand. And it kind of hints that we might have peaked in the human use of water in California. It might be growing a little bit, but it's not growing great guns like it used to for decades and decades and decades. And so I think that helps civilize the conversation a little bit. The chart below shows the relative share of different sectors of California's economy in the overall economy. Of course, today you have to realize we have a $2 trillion economy in California. Of that, about $45 billion a year is agriculture. So, less than 5%, less than 3%, really. However, if you look at the structure of a California economy, we've gone from a mining economy to an agricultural economy to industrial to sort of post-industrial economy in terms of where all the money is coming from, where all the people are employed. Imagine what this drought would have looked like to the economy of the overall state of California if we still had 30% of our population as farmers. Right? We would really we'd be feeling it much more directly. So I often tell people that it's really kind of lucky that we have, that the agricultural impacts are fairly large. We'll talk about them in a minute. But we have the rest of the economy to sort of hold us up on the agricultural side and to help provide some buffer. And we've certainly seen that in this drought this year. We had probably worse impacts than the most recent drought year, which was 2009. But in 2009, the whole state was in a recession. And the rest of the economy wasn't around to pull out those, to provide alternative employment for people that had lost their agricultural jobs. It's not as booming as we would like it here, but it's certainly much better. The other thing I think that really helps with California water is we all agree, pretty much all agree, and I think the voting on Proposition 1 shows this quite well, that we have a problem with water. Talk just a little bit about agriculture in California. For those of you that are not from here, there are 400-plus commercial crops in California. You know, I go to some of the Midwest states, my impression is you've got like two or three, soybeans, corn, and what else is there? It's about $45 billion a year in sales. It's the most agricultural value of any U.S. state. We have about 4 million hectares of irrigated agriculture. It's about 9 million acres, about 40 billion cubic meters. I made the slide one of those in China. But it's a very small proportion of the total state economy, which has some benefits. You can sort of see where the bigger crops are. The alfalfa is the biggest in terms of irrigated area. Then comes almond and pistachios, not far behind. We have about a third of our irrigated agriculture today is in permanent crops. This is a big change from the earlier droughts in 76, 77, and even the late 80s, early 90s. So today we really have to make sure that we have that groundwater available to keep those permanent crops going in dry years. And I think you might have gotten a sense for we have a lot of different water management activities that we do in California, a whole broad portfolio of activities that we do in almost every, certainly the urban areas, but many of the agricultural areas have a whole big range of things they do. And there's a tremendous plumbing system that allows us to intertie many of our systems. Now, we do have some important areas that are off the grid. I think the previous speaker had a really nice way of putting it. But even there, I think you have a lot of things that people are doing locally. This makes California's water system very complex, but there's some really nice things about a complex system. You've got a lot of options. If you have a very simple system and something breaks, you're stuck. Here, we've got a very complex system. When you have a drought, there's a lot of things you can do. Here's a summary of the drought impacts that we estimated in a report with Richard Howitt and some others late in the summer. We estimate there's basically a 6.5 million acre-foot reduction in surface water availability in the state. That's about a third of the agricultural water supply. Okay, consumptive use, 25 or 30%. Farmers respond by increasing groundwater pumping by about 5 million acre-feet. So basically about 70% or so of the response to drought has been pumping groundwater. That's the biggest thing that we've got done to get through this drought, is have groundwater available. This left us a net of about 1.5 million acre foot of shortage for crop production, agriculture. We had about an 800 million reduction in crop revenues because of it. And that groundwater pumping, we had to pay for that, so that's about $500 million. And there were, of course, livestock and dairy revenue losses. So the overall economic impact in the agricultural sector is about $2.2 billion and about 17,000 job losses. California has 38 million people. We probably have at least 500,000 people unemployed in California. So 17,000 jobs, that's a lot of jobs, especially if it's your job. But if you look at it statistically compared to the overall economy, it's in the noise. So it's important, but statistically you wouldn't be able to see it if you were just looking at it from outside. To give you an idea of the acreage reductions we saw, we're estimating anyway, and it varies a lot in different parts of the state. You can see the mostly the acres are reduced in grain crops, not so much in fruit and vegetables, the high-value most profitable crops. So the farmers, there's two responses now. Groundwater is cheap, so pump groundwater as much as you can. And then when you still have a shortage, if you're a farmer, what are you going to do? You're going to reduce the water to your most profitable crops? Probably not if you're going to be a farmer for very long. So as a good business, you're going to reduce your watering of the least valuable crops. And maybe if that's all you have is least valuable crops, you might even sell some of your water to your neighbor who has tree crops. And we've seen a fair bit of that this year. There's a lot of talk. Unfortunately, you can't see the trends, the plots in there. There's a lot of concern that the prices of food in the United States and in California would go huge with this shortage. But because most of the reductions in crop production occurred in crops for which California is a small part of a global market, the lower value crops, we haven't really seen much of a price change. And because most of the water has still gone to the high value almonds and pistachios and things like that. So we haven't really seen much of a price change. Hay prices have gone way up, as you might expect. You can see a little bit on these maps where the fallowing is. It's the Tulare Basin, where the previous speaker is from, but also scattered elsewhere. That's just an overview of the drought. California's water systems. Really, drought tests our water systems. If you go to anywhere and look at the history of water, particularly in California, you'll see the history of water is a history of droughts. And droughts are really what is needed to bring political attention to something, legal attention. So this drought, we got a big change in groundwater legislation, as was mentioned. Previous droughts in the 1930s is what was needed before we started to build reservoirs and even irrigation systems. I was talking with a really smart flood control engineer from the Netherlands a few months ago. We were touring the Delta, and he was telling me that every generation, even in the Netherlands, needs a threatening flood just to keep sharp, you know, just to keep everybody's attention, just to keep the government agencies awake and the politicians awake and the public awake. Same thing is true in California with droughts. Just think of the terrible things that would happen if you didn't have hurricanes for 10 years on the East Coast and then you get a hurricane. No one would remember how to do an evacuation, right? It would be really devastating. And you saw some of that with Hurricane Sandy, because they hadn't been hit by a hurricane in a very, very long time. So we got to have a threatening droughts, not catastrophic droughts, just enough to get our attention and to make us update things. This is the current, where's the, I have a pen here, but not a point. Oh, here's the pointer. This gives you a sense for what droughts look like in California. So our water year, as was mentioned, starts on October 1st. This is the last drought year, 2014. You can see we didn't really get any precipitation until beginning of February. Then we got 1, 2, 3 decent storms, and that's about it. There's our annual drought. Let's look at, compare that with the 2005-2006 water year, which was a moderate flood year. We had what, one, or where are we? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 storms, and some of those storms were bigger, most of those storms were bigger than what we got in the drought year. So the difference between flood and drought in California is a few storms and how big they are. It's a very different, it's a weird climate. Someone mentioned snowpack. Here's the snowpack data for 3 different parts of the Sierra Nevadas. You can see that the snowpack this last year was basically tie for the lowest we've had on record, which was 76-77. And then someone showed this map before, showing how little we have left in storage. So lessons from this drought, I think, are that droughts are inevitable. The portfolio approach has really been very helpful. If this drought continues, we're going to have an urban drought this year. The last year was really only an environmental drought and for the native ecosystems and agricultural drought, but the urban guys will be feeling it this coming year if it continues. Groundwater is a big event. Water markets, again, important for better distributing what we've got. The value of having state agencies work together at the beginning of the drought, this was a problem, and I think it's really improved in the last few months. And then the value of information, and I think the important thing is to point out the importance of doing a retrospective on this drought so we can see what we've learned. Essentially, droughts are a test, and you want to grade the test after you've taken it, right? Now I want to talk a little bit about the topic of this, which is some big changes in California that are going to occur, and this is a list. We had a nice blog on this a few months ago called Resistance is Futile on some big changes that are coming to California water, but I modified this a little bit this morning for changes in agriculture, and some of these have already been mentioned. The first, and I think a really important thing, is more permanent and high-value crops. California's agriculture is going to struggle, but it's not going to struggle to be profitable. Whatever agriculture we have in California is going to be largely very profitable, because we're growing almonds and pistachios and wine and high-end stuff. You know, like, it's like not making Chevys and only making Mercedes. You know, you're going to do pretty well. We're going to have more environmental flows because we're a rich economy and we value the native ecosystems. We're going to see tighter groundwater management. I think this year has really shown that. And I think we need to have tighter groundwater management in two ways. We need to find more wet year recharge, both in fields and with artificial recharge, recharge basins, things like that. And more and seek to have more reliable wells and drought supplies. As was mentioned before, we have a tremendous problem with groundwater contamination with nitrate. This is really, I think, a problem all over the globe. This is probably not a new topic for this group of people. This is the price we pay for profitable and agriculture and well-fed people. Some land in the Central Valley in particular is going to be lost by salinization. This is a soil scientist. What is the proper salination? Salinization? What's the...
You got it right.
Salinization. Okay. Right. And also delta flooding. We have this subsidence problem with the islands in the delta. Some of those are just going to flood. A big thing we're going to have to work at is having less evapotranspiration off the landscape. And that's going to mean basically following irrigated agriculture. Not all of it, but a fairly decent chunk of it. Now, we'll go through a calculation in a second. This will take the form probably of having longer fallowing rotations and some permanent flooding. And on the environmental side, this will provide some more habitat. On the irrigation efficiency side, there's some nice mention of that earlier. I think we're going to have a dichotomy here where we would like to have inefficient irrigation in order to promote recharge in many areas of California. But on the other hand, one of our best ways of tightening up on the water quality loads to groundwater is by improving irrigation efficiency. So we have a dilemma there. This is almost my last slide on Southern Central Valley. And it's just to do a little mass balance here, since probably some of you have seen a mass balance before. So let's take that southern part of the Grand Central Valley, south of the Delta. The total consumptive use of evapotranspiration off that valley is about 15.3 million acre foot, plus or minus an acre foot, million acre foot, I think. About 5 million acres of irrigated agriculture there. In addition to that, there's about 2.5 million acre foot of southern outflow from the San Joaquin River. That's about half, less than half of what it would have been naturally. So environmentally, this is probably going to increase for the fish. The supplies for this 15 million acre foot, or 18 million acre foot of total use, is about 13 million acre foot a year of local inflows. Who knows what that's going to happen to that with climate change. About 4 million acre foot of imports from the Delta, those big water projects, and about 1 to 2 million acre foot of groundwater overdraft. Delta exports, imports, and groundwater overdraft are supposed to decrease. Remember that groundwater legislation, and for a whole host of reasons, it's not likely we're going to get more, and we'll probably get less water out of the Delta. So this leaves us a difference of between 2 to 4 million acre foot a year in the long term that the valley is going to have to, is not going to have. And that goes to about a million acres of irrigated agriculture. Some of this is going to retire due to salinity anyway, maybe a quarter of it. But most of it's going to retire due to water scarcity. But I expect, given the growing profitability of California agriculture, you might see a reduction in water use, a reduction in irrigated acreage, and more profits coming in anyway. So the good and the bad news is there. Next year will probably be dry. El Nino. Anybody pay attention to El Nino? This is my favorite chart. So this is the runoff from Northern California, and this is ENSO. You're a bunch of scientists. Tell me, how much attention should we pay to El Nino for drought in Northern California, in California? Yeah, don't. I try to use all the statistical wizardry in Excel. Got nothing. So there. Some more readings. I should stop there. Thank you very much.
Jay is not going to be here for the panel discussion. He has to catch a flight. So if you have questions, now would be the time.
Oh, since this is election day, while I'm passing the mic, what's this map of? For you Californians. No. This is the peripheral canal vote, 1982. I looked at this. I was originally a cultural geographer before I became an engineer, and I decided when I saw this map, oh, Northern California doesn't like Southern California. Maybe some of you are from other states where part of your state doesn't like the other part of the state. I'm originally from Delaware. The northern state doesn't like the southern state.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Delaware? Yeah.
No, no. I'm Northern California.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry.
I voted for Prop 1, by the way. You guys can clap if you want, but I didn't. But I was curious. There was $2.7 billion in there for storage. I was wondering, do you know how they came up with the $2.7 billion figure?
It came out of that great sausage machine in Sacramento.
Okay.
Jay, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about I noticed you had the increased fallowing and some permanent fallowing, and speak a little bit about the effects of the feedback of more fallowing on the snowpack storage.
I don't think it'll have any effect at all.
Really?
To speak of. So there's often a lot of discussion that the loss of snowpack with climate warming is going to be disastrous for California agriculture. I don't see that in our models. We already have a lot of reservoir storage. If you take a lot of more of the drought storage out of reservoirs and put it into groundwater, it frees up a fair bit of surface water storage. And so accelerating the runoff, seasonal runoff by a month or a few weeks, actually you can catch most of it. It's inconvenient, you lose some, but it's not catastrophic.
A couple of questions. One is, what would the economics be of building more storage? My understanding is that we can't pay for it. The other one is, what's the appropriateness of people in the community that we're visiting now irrigating lawns during such a period of drought?
Well, from an economic perspective, people should pay for what they get, right? And you should allocate scarce resources based on people's willingness to pay. And I think that also applies for investments in storage. So if people aren't willing to pay for storage, if the water you get out of new storage isn't worth the investment, why should we be paying for it? Okay. The water use here on lawns, about half of California's urban water use is to irrigate lawns, basically, urban landscapes. So basically that's 10% of human water use in California. So if we were to, I sometimes look at the landscape irrigation as our urban climate adaptation potential in California. Things can get really bad in California on water, and we can reduce the water use by 50% without really sacrificing any really core economics structurally. So I don't have a moral view on it. If people want to pay a lot of money to have farmer, you know, for water in urban areas and keep their lawns lush and drive a farmer out of business. You know, we do that all the time with all kinds of other things.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, I was just wondering about whether you foresee, or there's a, I guess I'm wondering about whether what happened in the Dust Bowl in the Midwest could be a model for the way we transition into land use management in California. Like, do you think that we would put more acreage into range or animal, sort of like long-term perennial crops for livestock or anything like that?
Most of our range land, I think, it's relying on that rain fed, so it's very seasonal. And then to get the crop, the animals through the rest of the year, either you have to ship the animals east of here, the other side of the mountains, or you have to import food or grow the extra food. So, again, it comes down to the economics of it. I don't think you're going to see a large growth in livestock in California on that basis.
We are a little bit behind at this point, so I'm going to cut the questions, but thank you, Jay.
Thank you all very much for the good questions.